Hello, good morning. So now I have a chance to talk to you about some of the innovative work that's going on in the state of Oregon with regard to healthcare reform. So a little bit about my background, which I think will be helpful. So I'm a family physician and preventive medicine physician by training, and half my time is spent clinically and the other half of my time is spent working for the state of Oregon with the Oregon Health Authority. And so the work that I'm presenting today is a lot of what we're doing with implementing the insurance exchange in Oregon. So essentially, and just to give you a framework, I realized looking at my title that it's a lot of words and it doesn't really make sense. But essentially what we're trying to do is develop healthcare packages that make people get healthcare that they should get, that's helpful, that improves health outcomes, and discourages healthcare that doesn't improve healthcare outcomes. And so it's really trying to intelligently design healthcare insurance. And I am not beholden to anyone. I shouldn't be, aside from I am a contractor for the state of Oregon, and that's why I do this work. So there are a number of co-authors who aren't able to be here with me today, but there are various staff and members of the Health Services Commission, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. So I think all of us knew this, but I feel like this is a really good image that is both very frustrating and inspiring. Essentially, we know that the U.S. spends more than twice as much as any other industrialized country on healthcare, and that might be okay if the result of that was we had much better outcomes and had a healthier and more vibrant population. And as we all know, that's not the case. And in many aspects, we come in dead last with comparison to other developed countries. So essentially, we're doing something really wrong, and we're spending lots of money doing it. I think what's interesting, too, is not just nationally we're sort of needing to fix this problem, but there's a lot of statewide variation. And this data, I don't know if everyone's familiar with the Dartmouth Atlas, but this is pretty fascinating data that's giving us really different insights into how geographic variation in the U.S. really alters cost and quality of care. But essentially, this is a map of the total rates of reimbursement for Medicare per enrollee. And so essentially what you see is the green states are spending sometimes half as much as the blue areas of states on Medicare. I mean, this is pretty tremendous, the difference between $7,500 per year per Medicare enrollee versus $15,000. So there's a lot of sort of speculation going on as to why there's so much geographic variation all over the U.S. right now. But I think what it tells me, you know, when we look back at this last slide, is the U.S. as a whole needs to do something, but also we really need to think about why we have such variation and what we can do either on a national basis or on a state-by-state basis to really try and improve this and get everybody into the green. You will notice that Oregon is green. But we still have lots of improvements to make. And so I think sometimes the public framing of this is not particularly helpful for those of us who are trying to do good work in this field, but essentially you've got two options. The first one is sort of the expanding coverage, which is going to result in exploding costs, and then the U.S. is going to all implode by 2080, is it, that we're going to implode? And then the other option is if you control costs, which they consider form of rationing, and then we get these crazy rumors about death panels and killing grandma and things like that. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of the public discourse happens on this level and really isn't an intelligent, how do we actually really improve health outcomes and decrease costs? And I'm not trying to pick on any particular political party. I just thought it was a very apt cartoon. So there are a number of ways to achieve this. We need to change patient behavior. We need to change provider practices, and we need to change systems. And I just threw this up here because this is a public health conference, but the whole improving health outside of the healthcare industry is pretty essential, and it's basically what public health is about. And I go to a lot of healthcare reform discussions, and very little of the time is this mentioned. And I really think that figuring out how to get public health back into the healthcare reform discussion needs to happen, and it needs to happen with a lot of strength. But in terms of what we're focused on, the state is working on a number of different, we're working on all of these issues. But this particular topic, we're talking mostly about changing patient behavior and changing provider practices and kind of designing the insurance exchange system to encourage this. So within the insurance exchange, which actually Oregon was excited about before the federal government came up with the idea, so we've been working on this for a while, it really gives us an opportunity. It could just function as a marketplace, but it also gives us a chance as a state. That's exciting. It gives us a chance as a state to say, what is it that we want every insurance package in Oregon to potentially offer, or at least some sort of plurality of them. But then we also have to think about who's deciding what's being in these benefit packages. Typically, it's been the insurance industry, you know, or employers. And so, you know, this is an opportunity here for the state to have some input into this and really garner the public input that we have the ability to gather. These benefit packages that have been largely decided by insurers, too, may or may not have a very large emphasis on the role of evidence in the development of them. And so this also gives us an opportunity to make sure that that's a big part of the development. And public opinion, obviously, is something that we're very interested in. So we were directed, we meaning the state of Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority where I work, were directed by the legislature in 2009 to develop an essential benefits package. So again, this is before the federal reform, before kind of we knew that we were going to have an essential benefits package given to us, so we have created our own. And these will be able to function in some way side by side within an insurance exchange. And what they told us is to base this on the prioritized list of health services. Is anyone familiar with the prioritized list? Nobody. All right, so this is basically the coolest thing. And I hope that at least some of you are really inspired to think about what this means a little bit more. But essentially, every state is faced with the issue, and I'll be very interested in your perspective of this at the end, but every state is faced with the issue of having a large population of low-income people and then a certain amount of money that they want to spend or can spend on Medicaid. And so Oregon, back in the 90s, said, well, we've got all these people, and so essentially healthcare is really expensive, and if we cover everything for this group of people, we can only cover a certain population of the Medicaid. We're only going to be able to cover this many people. So they said, well, maybe we shouldn't be paying for everything. Maybe we should only pay for the stuff that works, for stuff that's helpful, for stuff that actually makes a difference in people's quality of life. And if we don't cover absolutely everything and we just cover those things that really work and make a difference, then we can cover more people and have a much broader Medicaid population that's covered. And so they did that. And so over about 1990 to 1994, there were a series of public meetings, lots of expert input, lots of national input, and we developed this prioritized list of health services. This is a little before my time. I was pretty young at the time. But essentially, this has been functioning since 1994, and I'm going to show you an image of what it looks like, but essentially, this list determines coverage for the Medicaid population in Oregon. There is the Health Services Commission, which is what I'm staff to, that is comprised of a number of public members. So we've got physicians on it, we've got lawyers, we've got disability rights advocates, we've got mental health advocates, we've got dental advocates who all meet every month or every other month and manage this prioritized list. And then the main work that our office does is to keep it going and then to do all the evidence reviews and kind of assessment of new technologies and new information and new medical literature to keep the prioritized list up to date. So the list itself is comprised of a list of diagnosis treatment pairings, which will be much more obvious on the next slide. And these services are prioritized based on the impact on individual and population health. And there's this complex formula, actually really neat, with about 6 or 7 factors that determine how much impact that service will have on a population. And then the effectiveness of treatment. So if you've got a condition that is very impactful, that will, you know, Ebola or something that kills you on sight, essentially, but we have no effective treatment for it whatsoever, that's going to be ranked fairly low. If we have something that has almost no impact on people's life, but we have no effective treatment, that would be ranked very, very low. But if it has almost no impact and a very high effectiveness, that might be ranked somewhere in the middle to low region. So essentially, it's a combination of how effective our treatment is and what is that impact that that healthcare service has on people's lives. Evidence has played an increasing role since about 2003, when that became a very deliberate attempt to make sure that the prioritized list was based on evidence-based care. And so now every single decision that we make is informed by the evidence. And then the funding line. So this is kind of the crux of it all. So every biennium, the Oregon legislature says, all right, so this is how much money we're going to spend on Medicaid. The actuaries run all their numbers and basically say each line on the list will cost this much. The Oregon legislature looks at that and they say, all right, we're going to spend this much. And a funding line is drawn. So things that are above that line are covered for the Medicaid population, and things that are below that line are not covered. And every 2 years, that line changes, depending on how much money that the legislature is able to spend on Medicaid. So this is just what it looks like. And I don't know how many people are into healthcare, but it's got ICD-9 codes, which are your diagnosis codes. So in pregnancy, that would be healthy pregnancy, scary pregnancy, that sort of thing. And then your CPT and HCPCS codes, which are essentially the procedures. So that's seeing your doctor, getting your lab tests, having a baby, and whatever method, complications of that. And so every line has this combination. And in order for something to cover it, you would need to have that diagnosis, healthy pregnancy, and the treatment, vaginal delivery, on the same line. And what you'll notice is that these are the top three lines. And we have pregnancy, the second line is birth of infant, and the third is preventive services up to age 10. And so I think this is really helpful just to see that the commission has been very deliberate in their attempt to put preventive services very, very high on the list. And so these actually didn't fall into the prioritization methodology that we used for everything else. These were hand ranked. Essentially, commissioners said these things are the highest value things that we want to be up there. They should be at the very top of the list. And then this gives you a sense of where other sorts of things are on the list. Right now, it goes down to about 678. I think we're at in terms of total number of lines. So the first line, as we talked about, is pregnancy. The second, this is just an example, so 101 is acute lymphocytic leukemia in children, not for adults. And then the treatment would be chemotherapy and radiation therapy. 201 would be subarachnoid hemorrhage and brain compression. You can have holes drilled in your skull for that, and everything else you might need. The 200s are many different cancers, to give you a sense of where the cancers are at. 401 would be a retinal tear. 501 is kind of inflammation of the cervix. And then 502 is our funding region. So essentially, everything above this line is covered, and everything below this line is not. So some examples of things that are not covered by Oregon Medicaid are allergic rhinitis, so runny nose, hay fever, that sort of thing. Medical therapy is not covered. Line 601 is candidiasis, so this is a yeast infection of the mouth and the skin and the nails. This is something else that's not covered. TMJ, this is a temporomandibular joint disorder. It can cause pain, but surgery for that is not covered. So again, the reasons that these things are below the line are because either they do not have a big impact on people's health, or we have very ineffective treatments for them. So as part of the essential benefits package, as I said before, we were told to base it on this list. But we always like to do extra things. So we decided that we're also going to create another category because we have this opportunity, which is to create a series of value-based services. So these were going to be a bunch of services that kind of went above and beyond the prioritized list that were so great that we wanted to create this other category for them. And the goal of these is really to incentivize appropriate care. We really like these services. We really want patients to get them. We really want providers to recommend them. So using kind of the insurance as a tool to encourage a specific group of services. And so the essential kind of overall framework then to what we're creating with this benefits package is a design that really is based on value and cost. So services that are high value are low cost, and services that are low value are high cost to patients. And through doing this, you really are incentivizing people to spend money or not spend money, as the case may be, on things that are going to be really helpful because they'll be free for them. And things that aren't very helpful, people can choose to spend lots of money on them, but the state, with its limited funds, isn't going to pay for that. And tiered coinsurance, I have to say about 10 years ago, that probably would have put me to sleep. It's pretty fascinating. And it really is based on this idea that you're trying to really match value and cost to a patient's perspective. So if we put in the value-based services into this, this is essentially the tiered coinsurance design that we have. So the value-based services, and I'll tell you more about what those are, but they include things like routine vaccinations, prenatal care, chronic illness management, smoking cessation treatment. So the cost sharing on these, meaning if a patient goes into a doctor, they would have to pay nothing to either see the doctor, to talk about tobacco cessation, or to do any of those things, they would have nothing. It would be a free visit for them. Their medications could be free. Everything would be free, with the goal of really encouraging people to use these services. Tier one then would be kind of the highest lines on the list. So these are things that are going to kill people and we have very effective treatment for. Tier two would be this 113 to 311 range. So these are life-threatening illness and injury and chronic diseases, but not quite as severe as the highest ones. And the cost sharing on this would be moderate. And you'll notice that there aren't specific numbers because this is kind of up for companies to decide. Tier three is 312 to 502, so these are the lowest lines in the covered region of the list. And this is effective care for non-life-threatening illnesses. So this is like ear infections, herniated discs in the back, reflux or bad heartburn, and dentures. And so the cost sharing on this would be high. And then this area, tier four, so this is currently not covered for the Medicaid population. So these are the bottom lines on the list. So these are, it's either less effective or these are self-limited care, and this area would be the highest cost sharing. So for the Medicaid population, it's 100%. For a commercially insured population, it could be 50%, it could be 80%. Basically, that's kind of up to the future. But this would be the application of the prioritized list, adding in the value-based services for offering the insurance exchange. So I think it's really interesting to go into these value-based services. Just as part of the ACA, there were a number of services that the federal government required to be offered free through all insurance companies. And many of the things that they've recommended are also in our value-based services, but we have a number that go beyond that as well. And so I'm going to talk in a little more detail about them. But essentially, these services would be provided barrier-free, meaning cost-free, so totally available to people. And the goals of this are really to improve health, to prevent worsening of disease, and to reduce costs. I think you've got the little or no cost. But I really want that in caps and underlines, you can see. So the Health Services Commission, so this is this public body that manages a prioritized list, is what developed the criteria for these services. So they decided they needed to be ambulatory. They need to be primarily offered in a medical home, focused on chronic illness management, preventive care, or maternity care, of clear benefit and strongly supported by the evidence, really unequivocal evidence basis for it. They needed to be cost-effective. Initially, we talked about cost-saving, and then had a very discouraging foray into the medical literature and found out that very little of what we do is cost-saving, and most of it really is cost-effective. So I think we have four conditions that are cost-saving, and everything else is cost-effective. So these value-based services need to reduce hospitalizations or emergency department visits or improve the quality of life. They need to have a low cost up front. We really want to encourage people to use these services. And if they're overused, there's a low risk. So the process for this, so we identified a series of conditions that we used our clinical judgment to have a very strong evidence base that was already known. These conditions need to be very high already on the prioritized list because obviously that's sort of a pre-screening. And then we also reviewed similar proposals in other states and what was happening in the background at the federal level. And then we refined these value-based services through a series of our commission meetings. So the evidence base was systematic reviews, health technology assessments, and high-quality evidence-based guidelines. And these are kind of examples of our core sources. And that's a lot of acronyms, and I can explain any of them. But kind of the big ones are Cochrane's Database of Systematic Reviews was a really reliable resource. We have the OHC Center for Evidence-Based Policy. There's this multi-state Medicaid Evidence-Based Decisions Project. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, but we basically get really excellent systematic reviews through this multi-state consortium. And then the UK has a wonderful set of national guidelines called NICE, which we use a lot. And then the USPSTF is there as well. So these are what we came up with. And I'm just showing you a range of them, not all of them, but dental services. So for children, oral fluoride supplements, fluoride varnish, and Pitt and Fisher sealants. So these would all be offered free for children. Contraception. So that includes everything from condoms to pills to intrauterine devices and sterilization. All of these would be offered free with no copays or little copays. Tobacco cessation, So that would include nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, and nortriptyline. You'll notice that there is one medication that's missing from this, and that's, I see lots of nods. So that's Chantix or varenicline, and that's because it doesn't meet the cost criteria. It's too expensive. So this particular example is important because, so tobacco cessation on the prioritized list is line 7. And so things are covered on line 7, but for something like Chantix, there would be a prior authorization process. So basically, you would need to try nicotine replacement, bupropion, or triptyline before you'd even have access to that. And while these would be free for somebody, somebody's still going to have to pay a little bit to Chantix. Because if we covered that for everybody, we wouldn't have money for anything. coronary artery disease. Apologize for the CAD shortening of that. But essentially, you'd see a number of medications like aspirin, statins, and beta blockers. Labs, so we'd pay for an annual cholesterol assessment, and procedures, doing an electrocardiogram, and then cardiac rehabilitation for post-heart attack patients. So all of these things are evidence-based to improve health outcomes, decrease hospitalization. This is really impressive for decreasing death and rehospitalization. For diabetes, we'd cover, you know, some of these are $4 medicines, the metformin and sulfonylurea. Things like insulin are not $4. They're very expensive, and so this would be offering these things for free or with very low cost sharing. ACE inhibitors are a type of blood pressure medicine that are very good for diabetics. A series of labs, and then diabetic retinal exam, which is proven to prevent blindness.
Do A1C, is it covered every 3 months?
Oh, we left it vague. Yeah.
I was just wondering because I think the guidelines suggest.
Yeah, so the reason that we left that particular one out was because somewhere between 3 and 6 months, if somebody's doing great, you could actually probably spread it out to every 12 months. And this is really where we got into the issue, do we think people are overdoing it? Probably not. You know, is it a super expensive test? It's not. And the benefit of it is that people are really going to manage diabetes more regularly. So with this particular one, we kind of debated the 3 to 6 months and decided just to leave it open, and then we would just pay for it whenever people ordered it and hope that doctors didn't go crazy. But with lipid profiles, we did limit that to once a year because it's a little bit more expensive, and we thought that people might be going crazy with that. Immunization, so we base these on the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is the federal or national committee, to cover all adult and child immunizations, which are recommended by them for free or with very little cost sharing. And then we did consider some mental health services. So for adult depression, major depression, severe only. So most depression in the U.S. is diagnosed as either mild to moderate. That would fall somewhere else on the prioritized list. In terms of the value-based services, it's really only severe that we've put on this highest level. And for that, we would cover a specific type of medication called SSRIs, which are like Prozac or Celexa, and then also cognitive behavioral therapy or interpersonal therapy. So we would cover both of those, again, with no copays or very little copays. And then for mild to moderate depression, it would fall where that is on the list, which is somewhere around, there's one on 39 and one on 200. And so in general, because now the state would be, or commercial insurance companies would presumably be assuming some of the cost, we gave a series of recommendations about what types of medicine should be used. So generics should be used unless there's no equivalent available, and medications for less than $4 per month are preferred to more expensive medications, which is just good sense. So the other categories of value-based services, which I won't go into, but asthma, bipolar, cancer screening, and that's basically recommendations by the USPSTF. Chemical dependency treatment, so that includes methadone and buprenorphine. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, that's essentially just an albuterol inhaler for breathlessness. And there's not great data about the rest of it being all that helpful, unfortunately. Congestive heart failure, that's pretty similar to the diabetes coronary artery disease package. Depression in children, that includes psychotherapy. Hypertension, that's basically a series of antihypertensive medications as recommended by the JNC7. Maternity care, newborn care, and tuberculosis.
Do you only cover albuterol
inhalers for COPD? So this isn't albuterol, this isn't coverage. This is at this very highest level of value-based services. So these are low cost, incredibly effective, really make a huge improvement in people's lives. So COPD is, I think it's somewhere in the low 300s, so it would fall on the list somewhere else, and it would be subject to some copays. But this, for this highest level of, these are the best healthcare services that we essentially have that really make a difference in people's lives, only albuterol has enough evidence to really suggest that it makes a huge difference in the lives of COPDers. And oxygen, but oxygen doesn't meet the low-cost criteria. Are you? Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, COPD is covered on the list, you know, and then people could get their other medications and their inhaled steroids. But, you know, there's conflicting literature on those. Some of those, you know, there are some studies that they increase mortality or decrease, you know, we're not even sure if they really improve mortality right now. And so...
But that doesn't even go by the guidelines. And I know you had a slide about high-quality guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So your coverage isn't going by school guidelines.
Okay, so again, this isn't coverage.
Oh, yeah.
This is the high. This means that we're going to hand people albuterol inhalers for free, but we're not going to hand them inhaled steroids for free. They may have their $4 copay or their $10 copay or their $50 copay, depending on, you know, which one it is. We're basically saying that these are such fantastic services and they make such a difference in people's lives that we really just, we kind of want to give it out like candy because it's so good. And for the other, do you see what I mean? Like, we're basically creating no barrier for these things. Tobacco cessation, we want people to use this stuff because it makes such a difference in their lives.
And in healthcare, we don't want them overusing their albuterol.
Yeah.
So it just kind of conflicts, so that's why I'm interested.
Okay. So this is really a cost-sharing approach. Essentially, we're trying to incentivize the stuff that really helps people, and we're trying to disincentivize the things that don't necessarily have the high-quality outcomes that we're looking for or are considered non-essential services. And then these value-based services are really, we'd like to offer them for decreased or non-existent cost-sharing, so either free or at very, very low cost. The goal is to really incentivize preferred behavior to improve health, and they are based on solid evidence. So the estimate of impact. So cost sharing is not necessarily the most powerful tool we have. It's definitely a deterrent, but making things free for people doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to adopt everything. We're still going to have a lot of issues with adherence. I've learned not to say compliance anymore. We're still going to have a lot of issues with adherence just for a variety of reasons, you know, whether that's transportation to your doctor, to your clinic office or to your pharmacy, whether that's just patient preference. There are a lot of reasons for that. But essentially, the idea of this would be, based on current use of these particular therapies, we'd expect a 10 to 20% increase in the use of all these services. And so the total savings, it really depends on how much cost sharing is an effective tool. There isn't great data on this. Some of the data goes back to the 1970s with the RAND studies. There just isn't good data. But we do expect improved health. Some of this won't be seen within the Medicaid population or within the commercial population because many of the savings are going to be downstream and mostly affect Medicare. But our goal really is not just to save money, it's also really to improve health, even if the federal Medicare is obviously the beneficiary of it, which is great. So, and this would also really improve adherence to evidence-based guidelines. So other things to consider, instead of just kind of using this on the patient aspect, is how much do we want this to affect providers? And so one option then is to reimburse providers differently depending on what sort of services are being provided. So value-based services might be reimbursed more highly. You know, tier one and tier two, more highly. And tier three and tier four could be reimbursed lower. So this is another potential tool that we have. This is kind of interesting. So this is the Archimedes model. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that. I see some head nods. But essentially, we did some modeling of how much the change in the use of these value-based services and the list would improve healthy life years. And this is just the value-based services category. This isn't using the whole prioritized list. But essentially, with this orange line, you can see that in 10 years, we would expect 10 fewer people out of 1,000 to die or have a major cardiovascular event as a result of providing these free. So these aren't breathtaking numbers, but they're real numbers, and these are people's lives. And again, the other thing is we're going to see a lot more benefit in the Medicare population, and then this doesn't take into account cancers or other things. So if we do all this, what sort of savings would we get? So our actuaries, our research analysts have told us it'll be about 3 to 5%. So this isn't gonna This isn't going to completely bend the cost curve. It's not going to stop it altogether. But that's not insignificant. And not only is it savings, but now we know that it would be based on evidence. We know that we'd be getting people the care that really improves health outcomes. And we'd be doing it based on an informed process that has had a lot of public input. Yes?
I'm sorry, the 3 to 5%, would that be like in a year, or is that over, 10 years down the road?
The overall, within the, let's see, we just had a discussion about this. So that was over a 2-year process.
So I would imagine, though, that theoretically, like 10 years down the road, the cost savings would theoretically be huge, because you're preventing all the, if someone's high blood pressure, you're preventing their MI.
Yeah.
But it seems like one fold in that assessment or that model is that if you've got people living 10 or 15 years longer receiving Medicaid services, mm-hmm. those additional costs for those years, So when you sort of subtract one from the other, I wonder if there's actually a net savings over a 10 or 15 year span.
Well, so we don't have a lot of deaths in the Medicaid population, because most of those deaths are going to happen in the Medicare population. And so we do see overall savings. And the prioritized list has resulted in savings.
I'm sorry, just another question while you're looking this way. How complicated is it for you when that line shifts every 2 years? And I don't know how much variation there is. I used to live in Oregon. I think it shifted like 100 lines in one budget cycle. How difficult is that for a provider, in terms of educating providers, okay, now this is the new line, and making sure that they're informed each budget cycle in terms of those changes?
Yeah, so every biennium it changes how much the line moves, and some biennium it doesn't change at all. And the 100 sounds like a lot. We used to have a lot more lines on the list, and so like with the dental lines, they just went from like 13 to 30. So sometimes we just sort of expand the number of lines without really changing things. In terms of communicating with providers, it's a fairly big process for us to get. We have to ask approval from Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services federally in order to increase our line, and we've got a waiver, which is what allows us to do this. But in terms of communicating with providers, I mean, they see it a combination of different ways. I think mostly they would see it through their managed care plans, which let them know. Yes?
When you're deciding what drugs to give do you make any attempts at looking at the adverse side effects? Is that
Yeah, we do. Was there anything in particular you were concerned about?
No, I was just curious.
Okay. Yeah, so we really look overall at the efficacy and the potential harms and really balance all of that. Yes?
Finish up. In order for it to work at the incentivizing tool, part of it is that both providers and patients have to understand, have knowledge about the cost of things, because if it just exists out there, but people aren't making decisions based on cost, then it's not actually helping the providers. So my question is, how are you communicating, primarily actually the patients, how are they learning about what is free, what's free, what are the free candy things that are handed out, and what ones are you disincentivized? How are patients learning about it?
So the value-based services has been published. We've let the managed care plans know about that. And we have yet to see how it's going to be adopted into the insurance exchange, so we're not sure outside. Our population, the Medicaid population, basically already gets everything free, and so for them it doesn't make a huge difference. There have been some changes that have happened with this, but mostly for the Medicaid population it doesn't affect it. What it's really going to affect, because everyone gets free services already, but it's really going to affect the commercially insured population a lot more. And in terms of informing patients about what's covered and not, a lot of that just comes through providers. We've had 15 years now for people to learn what's covered on a prioritized list and what's not, and providers who serve Medicaid patients are very aware of that and can let patients know. And then I'm being told I need to wrap up. So
keep going. We're going to keep going to finish our presentation, and then we'll have more time for questions for both speakers at the end.
All right. Well, I'm almost done. I had to put in a cartoon. But so this says, we tried every fix the insurance companies allow, but it still won't fly. So this is a tribute to two things. One is we need to think outside the box, but we need to think broadly and more small. So I think at the state level, we have a real opportunity to do some pretty innovative reform, and nationally, obviously, we still need to do some thinking to get our plane off the ground, or maybe just build something else. So overall, the purpose of this value-based benefits design is really to increase the use of effective services, to enhance primary care, to decrease costly imaging, expensive medication, and inappropriate visits and procedures. So overall, this really does further the triple aim, the Institute of Medicine's triple aim. It incentivizes the most effective services, and it's based on evidence. So the logistics for us next, we're going to figure out how to apply this to public purchasers within Oregon. So that's like the public employees and the education employees. We will need to adjust it to the federal reform limits, and as the more clarity comes as to what the federal essential benefits package is, we'll see how it relates to ours, and then figure out how to make that work. And then we're going to determine how to couple this with payment reform. That's kind of a big question out in the air. And then make this available for commercial purchasers as well. Thank you.
Frequently, you validate the simulation model against what you actually see out there with a population, for example. I know you build it, and you have behavioral assumptions in there about things like price elasticities and so on. But how often do you check that? And when you do, how close is it to the results in some sense?
Okay, well, the model that we're using now is the successor to the one that was used to do the initial modeling for the Massachusetts health reform. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the results when the Massachusetts reform was implemented actually came very close to what we predicted. And other models actually predicted much lower rates of uninsurance after reform. But it turned out, so some were sort of gravitating towards those because that was more on message. But it ended up being closer to our estimates on that. We update the model every year, so we bring in the latest data, but we also project it because there's still a gap between the latest available survey data and the current year of the baseline. So we do some projection there, and so part of that is estimating how changes in the uninsured rate affect health coverage. So the big jump in the uninsured in the CPS last year. Basically, that was already in our baseline. What we were saying before was that it was already very, very close to that. But as far as the implementation of healthcare reform, until these things go into effect, there's no independent verification. But Massachusetts was sort of the closest possible thing.
Speaking of Massachusetts, to make a long story short, my brother lives in Massachusetts, and he had to go to Rhode Island to get into a primary care provider when this occurred because there was such a huge wait and there wasn't enough primary care providers. So how will the healthcare system handle all these insured folks that are going to become insured, especially for primary care, medical homes? He was seeing specialists because he had some... get diabetes,
right.
But
he had to go to another state to get into a primary care provider. Yes.
Because they gave him
like
18 month wait.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the state officials in Massachusetts would dispute that there was an overall crisis in primary care use. And the studies about whether health reform by itself led to primary care prices are somewhat mixed. It does appear that certainly in the early years of reform, it did appear to accelerate.
So, is there
enough
primary care providers to handle all the new insurance, but
also that is because and Massachusetts is one of the ones that has one of the more better developed networks of providers. I mean, if you're in a rural area of a larger western state, for example, yeah, so so I think that's a very, or a state in which provider networks for Medicaid are already limited and stretched. I think that is a very real, that is a very real issue in some localities. That could very well be the thing. Actually, that's one of the things that we intend to use the ACS with our American Community Survey with our model, and then model. We're currently focusing on costs. We're planning on moving more towards modeling organizations and services to be able to do some forecasting like that. But yes, in some areas that is a real legitimate concern. On the Massachusetts one, I don't specialize in that, and I know there have been there are adamant people holding up data on both sides. So I'm not.
I live in a state, county in California where estimated 1/5 of the population is undocumented.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if anybody's looking at projections about the cost that non-coverage will have for that population.
Yes. So that is something we can look at currently at the state level, but we don't have the sample to go below the state level. That's something we hope to address in the future.
But it's very complicated to look at it at the state level because people don't ask.
Right. And for safety net issues, the local is far more important than the state level. So yes, but there's a lot that needs to be done to be able to produce reliable results at that more local level. Yes.
I have a question about the characteristics of the higher income people who have an affordable option available to them, but maybe no subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
What are their characteristics? Are these people who are just unaware that the option exists for them, or they're willfully choosing not to take that option? And then will the fines that they face or the penalties under the individual mandate encourage them to later join? What are you showing me?
Right. Well, these are there certainly is a definite voluntary component there. That is the ones who are not voluntarily insured. They're the ones for whom the penalty is not enough to move. So they are there, and on some of them are high compensated care users.
High ED utilizers.
So well, we can't really go into that in detail. As Sherry Fleet pointed out a while back, uncompensated care works very much like a catastrophic only insurance policy, except that you don't pay the premiums, the taxpayers and the providers do. So those who are already high utilizers of uncompensated care may have less motive to move to private coverage.
Question for Dr. Livingston. I really liked your presentation. I thought it was very powerful. Actually, two questions. The first one is, you mentioned that we don't know much about the cost-sharing sensitivity of all those different services that you're talking about. The RAND study, of course, you alluded to. Has there been any work that's been helpful in ambulatory care since RAND in terms of differentiating the price sensitivity of different kinds of ambulatory care services you're interested in?
Yeah. Okay. So there have been a number of, there's some good mental health studies that look at price sensitivities of mental health medications, particularly antipsychotics. Most of the data that's out there is really looking at disincentives. So it's looking at when insurance, when pharmaceutical benefits basically cut their coverage by half, how much people forwent essential medications. And it looks like even if there's a slight increase, people will give up everything. And they won't necessarily give up the things that you'd like them to as a provider. They'll give up their hypertension medicines and their diabetes medicines. So the medicines that they might give up may not be the best for their health. And most of the data that we were using was kind of on that opposite end of the spectrum. And so it was harder to, no one's actually saying, oh, let's make these services free. So there's almost no data on that. So we basically had to extrapolate from the inverse of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if price theory tells you if it's asymmetric on both sides or not.
Yeah, we don't know.
Probably.
Did you have a second question?
I did, but I thought I might be hogging.
I actually have a question for Dr. Livingston, which is that you've got it very well laid out on paper in terms of the values and what's going to pay for what's worth, evidence, all that kind of stuff. But within your system, what do you do about, like, for instance, the patient's allergic to the medicine that's on the $4 or that's the free one and stuff like that? How do you deal with those kinds of situations?
So it really depends, you know, on which service it is particularly. The example that we spent a lot of time on was with ACE inhibitors for hypertension and for diabetics. And so this is a blood pressure medicine that's really effective. There's another medicine that's an ARB, but essentially it's much more expensive and it does pretty much the exact same thing. And so in our guidelines, we say for people who are intolerant to ACE inhibitors, ARB would be covered for the value-based services.
And what kind of process do you have to go through in order to make that jump? Do you have to call a help desk and explain to get prior off, you know, to get the authorization?
So we're really leaving that up to the different managed care plans or commercial insurance.
I'm talking about in the Medicaid population, the state is actually administering.
So in our population, there's prior authorizations for the next step.
So this is leading into how much is the state of Oregon paying to administer their Medicaid program? This is their Medicaid program.
That's a big question.
I know, but that's the problem with all of this, is that the cost of the administration for these complicated problems is one of our big problems, and I want to know how the state of Oregon was addressing that issue.
Well, we have 3 full-time people in our office, so we're not a giving office. But essentially, I mean, I think it depends on, in comparison to other states, you know, 15% of our population is fee-for-service. The rest of it is all managed care plans. So I don't know how that compares exactly to other states, but our staff for managing this prioritized list is 3 people. And then we have public participants who basically are volunteers. So it's not very expensive.
No.
Yes.
My second question. The payment reform piece, how you pay providers. It's interesting, because here you have a situation where the plan is paying more for these good value-based services, and the patient is paying less, and appropriately incentive to use more. And if you were combining that for the provider, you'd say, and let's give the provider a little advantage for these as well. So it's in the short run, before the behavioral effects occur and the medical effects occur, it's cost raising for the administration and the plan. I think it's the right way to go. I also think it's very tricky. And I suspect there'd be a specialist versus primary care physician battle over that as well, like we saw with RBRBS back 20 years ago, when it was supposed to rebalance things a little more in the direction of primary care. It's my impression that didn't happen, at least not in anything like the degree we thought. So I'm sorry for the comment. How far do you think you'll get with the provider payment form of this? Are you an optimist, a pessimist, and what's the timeline?
I'm an optimist, but we haven't gotten into the details yet.
Applaud you for moving in that direction, because I think it's the right one.
For Dr. Livingston, curious as to whether there's ever been interest in Medicare subsidizing some of the value-based packages from the Medicaid side, and for a set of investments sort of over the lifetime?
Say it again.
Is there any interest in cost sharing essentially between Medicare and Medicaid? So if some of these preventive services and paying for them is going to pay off in the long term, would it make sense for a payer like Medicare to sort of share money with Medicaid?
What makes sense in healthcare and what happens in healthcare? Maybe. you know, Medicaid is such a state administered, and Medicare is federally administered, and I don't know how those two shall meet. I think it's a really interesting idea. I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yes, although the provisions of the ACA do mandate more coordination between Medicaid and Medicare for dual eligibles. So that's back to that coordination, but something larger. But I think that's a part that certainly is never that's sort of another